Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hello, everybody. We have a rare opportunity now to spend some time with a federal judge. People on the bench rarely write books or talk publicly about their jobs, but New York federal judge Frederick Block, who has sat on cases involving terrorism, the Crown Heights riot, Kitty Genovese, Peter Gotti, and more, has now written Disrobed, an inside look at the life and work of a federal trial judge. Judge Block, I appreciate your book and you're giving us this time. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me.
Because of the movie theater massacre, let's begin with your take on gun crimes. You wrote that America's love affair with guns, bolstered by the lobbying of the NRA, affects jury rulings. Why do you say that?
Well, one of the chapters of the book I write is called Guns. And I think the important thing from my perspective is to try to communicate to people about the realities of what the gun laws are all about, the statistics that we have that we now can talk about. And there's so much emotionality when we talk about these types of issues. And, of course, the Aurora tragedy now is just another one of these terrible examples. And I think that people respond, and not inappropriately, emotionally to when these tragedies happen. But it's recycled. We've been through this before. We've seen Columbine. We've seen Fort Hood. We've seen so many of these types of situations. And the beat goes on. What can happen to stop this, I do not know. But I think it's terribly important for people to understand that the emotionality is one aspect of this, and the reality is another aspect. So I talk in the book about some of the reality factors, and I talk about the statistics here. And when you read them, you have to reflect about whether or not we should look upon the gun laws in a more realistic way. And, of course, it's a big issue here. But when we talk about
You're looking up your stats.
Yeah.
Because obviously we have a lot more gun crime, gun violence in this country, and I know you refer to this in the book, than in any other industrialized country.
Well, look, for example, Brian, here, the statistics that I was able to find some years ago give us some sort of relative sense of how we deal with guns compared to other countries. New Zealand for the year 2004 had 5 gun deaths. Sweden, 27, 37. Australia, 56. England and Wales, 73. The United States, 11,344.
It's incredibly outsized.
Unbelievable. Bob Herbert's column that I referred to in the New York Times reports that we have 283 million privately owned firearms in the United States, that someone is killed by a gun in our country every 17 minutes, that 8 American children are shot to death every day, and that since September 11, 2001, nearly 120,000 Americans have been killed in non-terror homicides, most of them committed with guns.
And, you know, in following up on Aurora, we talked about a lot of this on the last hour of the program, but I want to hear how this gets into your courtroom, because instead of people being so outraged on this that they get tough on guns, you write about sympathetic juries, even here in New York City, to people who come into court charged with illegal gun possession.
I think it's reflective of our gun culture. So we have these felon in possession trials periodically in our court. Under the federal law, if somebody is a prior felon, then the court with the gun, they are then prosecuted for being in possession of a gun. That's one of the proscriptions that Congress has established.
Felons may not own guns.
Yeah. And so the jurors are sympathetic to these people because all they know about is that somebody has been protecting himself. They know about the NRA. They know about the Second Amendment. They know about the Supreme Court. They know that everybody seems to be armed in our country. And they have a hard time in these trials that I've presided over convicting people who just simply possess guns. And I think that that's reflective of the gun culture that we have in our country.
To the point where you write about cases of so-called jury nullification. Now, jury nullification was probably most famous in America around the time of the O.J. Simpson trial,
right,
where allegedly the jurors just didn't like the law, thought he should get off, and that's, you know, in the worst view of the jury, jury nullification, where the jury, in your case, acquitted an illegal gun owner despite the evidence and to protest the law.
There's no question about that, because I do make a habit of talking to the jurors after they render their verdicts. Not every judge does that, but I'm curious to find out, you know, a lot of things and to make myself available to the jurors to ask me questions that they may have. After this particular case, where there was no question in my mind that this person was absolutely in possession of the gun, the police saw the gun, there was no reason why there should be an acquittal, I was curious. And the jurors, I think it was the four-person volunteer judge. In our country, everybody carries a gun. The Supreme Court says it's legal. It wasn't exactly a correct take on the law. We're not comfortable in just, you know, convicting somebody for merely carrying a gun. And I was startled by that. But that was an absolute example of jury nullification.
And that wasn't in Texas. That was right here
in
New York City.
That was in New York City in Brooklyn.
And so at the end of gun trials now, you're right that you give your jurors an anti-nullification charge. What does that mean?
Well, not exactly. I don't tell them that they can disregard the law. But I sort of soft-pedal the issue here and not call much attention to it one way or the other.
Meaning?
I tell them they have to obey the law. But some judges, you know, go beyond that, and they really make a point of talking about the fact that they can't engage in jury nullification and make a big speech like that. I don't do that, but I do feel I'm obliged to tell the jurors that they have to follow the law, and I leave it at that.
Listeners, we have a rare opportunity to spend some time with a federal judge, Judge Frederick Block, who has written a book called Disrobed, An Inside Look at the Life and Work of a Federal Trial Judge. And if you've always wanted to ask a judge a question but never had a judge around to ask, now's your chance. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And basically anything relevant goes. Or post your question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So federal cases are not state and local criminal cases. You're a federal judge. Most crimes, from robbery to murder to drug possession, are state and local crimes. What actually tends to get tried as federal crimes?
Well, we have little understanding of the difference between state crimes and federal crimes. And a lot of it goes back to our founding mothers and fathers back in 1789 when they created this dichotomy between states' rights and federal law. And that beat still goes on. People are still debating this hundreds of years later. So one of the reasons why I wrote the book is to sort of give people an understanding of the difference between the federal system and the state system. Basically, the federal laws cover those statutes which Congress has enacted. So you can have murder cases in federal court as long as it's murder in aid of racketeering. That's the federal hook. Or murder in aid of, you know, violence or drug activity. On the state level, though, they are still trying murder cases all the time, but they don't have that extra federal dimension. So in many of these cases, the federal prosecutor and the local prosecutor will get together to decide whether to federalize the case, so to speak, by tacking it on to, you know, some crime that's proscribed by Congress.
What percentage of your cases are white-collar crime?
Well, in Brooklyn, we don't get a lot. The Southern District, which is our sister court right next door.
Manhattan.
And Manhattan gets most of the action. I had one big one that I did not write about in the book, the Bear Stearns case, where the two hedge fund guys were acquitted. And that surprised an awful lot of people because they were really being charged and prosecuted with basically taking Bear Stearns and putting it in the toilet. I don't think that was an example of jury nullification. I think that the jurors there just felt that, these people were not doing anything that everybody else was doing. And they asked me, why is it that these other people are not being prosecuted?
Huh.
But that was the big case. And I didn't write about it because it was pending while I was writing
right.
the book.
So now that you can talk about it. Do you think enough bank executives are being charged with crimes related to the housing bubble and the financial crisis, or are they getting away with things that should be seen as criminal?
I think Preet Bharara, the Southern District, the U.S. attorney, is doing a bang-up job and really doing a lot of this right now. And I think the more the merrier. There's no question about this, that this type of thing has to be rooted out. I just finished trying the Espada case, which dealt with the political person who was charged with taking money from his health care facility, and that involved hundreds of thousands of dollars. In the meantime, you have millions and millions of dollars being stolen by these predators, which are going unprosecuted.
Let's take a phone call. Jim in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with Judge Frederick Block. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Brian, I wanted to ask the judge if he thinks that perhaps one of the reasons for jury nullification that he's finding is that, as recent surveys have shown, people have just lost faith in the Supreme Court, and they want to take the law back and make it the law of their land, not the law of other people.
Thank you for your question.
It's a good question, Jim. I'm not so sure that that thought process is what I've observed. I think people, jury nullification has been around forever. And people who support it, even though it's not legally what ought to be done, believe that the public should have an opportunity to speak out against laws which they think are unjust or unfair. It's an issue that's going to, you know, continue to burn for many, many years. It's not the end of it right now. But I don't think that they really are thinking about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court approval rating, as we know, is down. I think the last statistics I saw said about 41% people approve of the Supreme Court, lower than perhaps any time in the history of the court. And we could talk about that on and on and on with Bush v. Gore and, of course, the Affordable Care case that just came down and Citizens United. I like to feel that what I've done here is some constructive way of communicating to the general public about what we judges really do. I mean, it's not all the Supreme Court. District Court judges is where really all the action is. That's where the people are. We handle 95% of all the judicial work, and yet people know so very little about what we do. Hopefully my book will shed some transparency and light on that.
Well, part of the debate about the Affordable Care Act ruling is, did Chief Justice Roberts rule on what he thought the law was or what he thought would be good for the Supreme Court's image of independence from politics? Do you have an opinion or any way to judge?
You know, I anticipated – I got up at 6:05 this morning thinking about what you might ask me, and that was one of the things I thought you might toss at me. I read Linda Greenhouse's article, I think it was on July 12th in the New York Times, and she talked about her favorite judge, Richard Posner of the Federal Appeals Court, and he was commenting to your colleague Nina Totenberg on NPR recently about that very same question. And his take was extraordinary, and I'll just read it quickly. He says, I mean, what would you do, this is Posner speaking, if you were robbed? So all of a sudden you find out that the people you thought were your friends have turned against you, they despise you, they mistreat you, they leak to the press. What do you do? Do you become more conservative, or do you say, what am I doing with this crowd of lunatics, right? Maybe you have to reexamine your position. I don't think I would have had the guts to say that, but I think I can quote from what Judge Posner said. And I think people are looking at Roberts as sort of, you know, taking the position to sort of vindicate the institution that he's in charge of. And I think that he's being given credit appropriately so for trying to make an effort to reestablish the independence of the judiciary.
David in Maplewood, you're on WNYC with Judge Frederick Block. Hello.
Hey, thanks, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
And Judge Block, I've appeared in your courtroom on a number of occasions when I used to work as U.S. probation officer there.
I remember you well.
My question for you is, I understand how juries can be sympathetic because they're made up from members of the community. And I had to go out in these communities, and, you know, some are like the Wild West. So, but what I wanted to ask you was, sometimes we would have offenders on supervision. They would get arrested for possessing a firearm. Now, that may become a new case. And after the case, as you know, they would come back to court on a violation hearing. And I've been retired for a few years. My memory's a little faded, but I always seem to think that the judges were somewhat liberal, sometimes just giving time served or, you know, not giving a consecutive sentence to that. And I'll listen to the answer up there, and nice speaking to you.
Thank you very much. You remember him from his voice, huh?
Yeah, I think we spoke more just now than we spoke in the past, but, you know, hope life is treating you kindly. You know, you get these labels bandied about, liberal, conservative, in between, whatever. I don't think my colleagues or myself certainly relate to those labels. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, you know, people hear these labels and they have these emotional reactions, which is something which I think we have to check out pretty carefully. You take each individual case. Sometimes I'm very tough with somebody who's a violator. Sometimes I'm more empathetic. I don't think there's any right or wrong about this. You guys do a great job, by the way. And you probably are frustrated, you know, when the judges, you know, don't do perhaps what you think we should do.
The probation officers, you're saying, do a great job.
Terrific. They have a, and they're understaffed. They're not paid properly. Congress is always cutting their budget. It's a shame because these are hardworking people and they deserve more respect than they get.
But on leniency, which was his question, you write very movingly in the book, I think, about sentencing people, which you have to do about three times a week. Do you consider sentencing the hardest part of your job?
I think all judges do. It's the most agonizing job. And I'll tell you what's particularly difficult, Brian, is when you have somebody who has never been in jail before and he hasn't committed a violent crime. When you're dealing with the mafia, it's 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. It's all important. You all have to think it through very carefully to come up with what your best judgment is. But they've been in jail before. They're acclimated. But somebody who's never been there, sometimes they have the hardest time deciding whether that person belongs in jail for a brief period of time on these so-called minor crimes. So I wrestle with those types of things. A lot of times people are out on supervised release or on bond before they get sentenced, and they come to you a year afterwards, and they've turned their life around. You have to take that into consideration because, you know, rehabilitation is really one of the goals of sentencing. So in answer to your great question, it's really an individual type of thing, and there's no one rule that governs everything.
And you write about decisions that you made on sentencing that go one way or another. For example, one in which you were going to sentence a man convicted of human trafficking and slavery, pretty serious thing having to do with sex trafficking, to 30 years, but at the last minute decided to give him 50 years because the particulars of the crime turned out to be so horrible and he seemed to show no remorse. On the other hand, you write about being fairly lenient within the guidelines on so-called drug swallowers. Who are they?
Well, I don't know whether everybody has seen Maria Full of Grace, that really poignant movie a couple of years ago about this young woman who was a drug swallower, came to New York. I think she died at the end. A lot of these people die. The ones who are picked up, you know, are prosecuted, and I say that, well, they're making their money the hard way.
They're couriers from South America?
They're couriers, they're swallowers, they risk their lives in doing it. They all come from impoverished backgrounds. These are desperate people. I still sentence them to jail, but I certainly am mindful of the fact that, you know, their dreadful lives, you know, requires a little bit of mercy on my part.
We will continue in just a minute with federal court judge Frederick Block, sits in the Eastern District in Brooklyn, as you heard, and he has written a book called Disrobed, an inside look at the life and work of a federal trial judge. We can talk about mob cases that he's had, terrorism cases that he's had, Lemrick Nelson, and anything else that you always wanted to ask a federal trial judge but never had one to ask. Here he is, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with federal court trial judge Frederick Block, sits in the Eastern District in Brooklyn and has now written a book called Disrobed, an inside look at the life and work of a federal trial judge. And Corey in Crown Point, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, Your Honor. The question that I have is...
And you're a lawyer, I gather, from my screen?
I am a lawyer. I've practiced in the Eastern District and in the Southern District. And what I very often see is that you see judges inundated with absolutely pointless motions that have no merit. And you get papers, you get reply papers, answering papers, you get reply papers, sir reply papers.
Right. Corey, hang on one sec. Judge, can you hear him now?
He's talking about all the papers we get, I think.
Right, inundated with paperwork, All these motions, et cetera, et cetera. So, Corey, go ahead. I'm sorry. We had a little trouble with the judge's headphones, but it's corrected.
And from the litigant's point of view, the cost blows completely out of proportion to what's at stake or what's reasonably an issue. And as a result, the judge, being inundated with all these papers, has to take time to decide motions, so the cases drag on. And For the average litigant that doesn't have unlimited resources, it really bars access to the courtroom for simply economic reasons. Now, every once in a while, you run into a judge like Ira Gamerman, who I'm sure you've met at one time or another. You know, and some judges are able to cut through this and just say, hey, look, I'm never going to grant the summary judgment motion in this case, so don't make it.
So can you do you take into account what the not deep-pocketed litigants are going through with motions like this?
You're absolutely right, and I like to feel that I'm a little bit like Judge Gamerman, but I do exactly that. I have conferences all the time before people make their motions, and I talk about their case. I tell them that, you know, I do this because I was classified dyslexic when I was a kid, so I sort of put the oral argument ahead of the motion, but I say that tongue-in-cheek, and I'm able to accomplish an awful lot by doing exactly that. So in my court, we're not inundated with the papers that you speak about correctly, and your comment is well taken.
Corey, thank you very much. Like a lot of judges in the New York area, you've been ridiculed from time to time on the pages of the New York Post or the Daily News. You write about this. What was that Daily News cover? Was it Judge Blockhead?
It was Judge Blockhead.
What was the case?
It was the death penalty case I had, Kenneth Supreme and McGriff. And it was clear to everybody that this should not have been a death penalty prosecution. No question he was guilty. He hired some people to get revenge on somebody who had killed his best friend. You know, I'm not saying he was entitled to any roses for that. But if you look at what death penalty cases are all about, no jury was going to, you know, convict somebody in New York State, especially of a death penalty in that type of situation. So I mentioned to the government after the verdict came in that you really want to proceed with, you know, all the money and all the time and the bother to process the death penalty phase, when you and I know that there's never going to be a death penalty verdict. It was set, the jury was not there. It was set at 5:30. The press picked it up, and the next day I had the pleasure of opening up the Daily News and seeing me referred to as Judge Blockhead.
Do you ever rule defensively to avoid publicity like that?
I try not to. And, you know, at my age, I feel freed up. I'm not going to be in the Supreme Court. I'm not going to be in the Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm where I'm at. And I think that's a certain advantage to getting older, and this is one of them. So I really feel that I don't have any subconscious problems in terms of trying to do the right job as a judge.
But the implication in that answer is that other judges do make decisions to keep themselves off the cover of the New York Post.
You know, I don't think any of my colleagues would have liked to have been referred to like Judge Weinstein head or Judge Deary head or Judge Ammon head. So, yes, they were, you know, do not want to have that happen to them, and I can appreciate that. But I think sometimes you just have to do what you feel is right and damn the torpedoes, and it's controversial, but, you know, I feel comfortable in my skin after all these years to do the right thing.
John and Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Judge Block. Hello.
Hi. Judge, it seems to me that the young prosecutors, for the most part, are calling the shots on sentencing these days because of the mandatory minimum sentences. Certainly in most drug cases and in child pornography cases, and that you really are not permitted because of those mandatory minimums to exercise your discretion in sentencing. I'd like to have your take on that.
I hate mandatory minimums. I think most of my colleagues do as well. When the founders, you know, created, you know, our Constitution, the first statute, they only had one. That was for murder. We now have 171 mandatory minimums. Most of them came on board in 1956 when Congress enacted the Narcotics Control Act. 80% of them are drug, but now child pornography has reared its head. And I write about that. And we don't have a lot in the EDNY because I really think that we have a
Eastern
very professional
District of
office.
New York,
yeah.
Your Brooklyn court.
So we get some. We shudder at that because it takes our discretion away. And I write about the fact that I don't think judges should be bean counters, that sentencing should be left to the judge and not to the politicians. It's a real sore issue, and I think that we have to be mindful of trying to make sure that we do not have all these mandatory minimums and having judgeships just basically neutered.
Has anybody challenged the constitutionality of mandatory minimums?
They haven't.
Under the notion that you know, Congress makes the laws, but it's the independent judiciary, independent under the Constitution, that decides on sentencing?
I think that's been done. But, you know, we have separation of powers. Congress does what it does. We do what we do. There's tensions. A lot of times the congressmen hate us because we are finding fault with their laws. There's this tension between the branches of government. They have control over us financially, which is a problem. We haven't had a pay raise since 1991. We're linked to Congress, and we don't get a cost of living – well, a couple of cost of living increases we had, but there's no location adjustment. So wonderful judges who are living in New York are really set upon and put upon, but Congress controls the purse strings, and it's a problem.
Federal judges haven't had a pay raise since 1991?
Since 1991. We've had four or five cost of living increases. We don't have any this year. We didn't have any last year, I don't believe. And look, nobody forces you to do the job. I mean, we're public servants. But you need to provide, you know, a means of livelihood for judges who have lots of children and who have never been, you know, working for large law firms. And we want those people to also be on the bench.
Marjorie in Belleville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
The reason I'm calling, I know this might seem silly, but I've read more than one article that said if a woman attorney appears in front of a judge that she should appear in a suit or a skirt, that if she appears in pants, that there will be, in front of a male judge, there will be an automatic prejudice. Is that accurate?
I don't do that. I may have a different problem if the man shows up in a skirt.
But I have read that.
I haven't seen any of that in our court. I don't think if a woman shows up in a pantsuit, I would be offended by that. We now have the majority of the active judges in our court are women. Our chief judges are women. I think the world has turned significantly in the last several years where women are embraced and are beginning to really dominate the judiciary.
Let's hope. Have you had terrorism cases?
I had the Iman Afzali. He was the Iman who was caught up in that Zazi case, as we called it, the plot to blow up the New York subways. And that's a recent origin. He himself was not a terrorist, but I had to sentence him because he was somewhat complicit when he was questioned by the FBI. He lied about his relationship with these people, and as a result of that, he pled to a an appropriate crime for not telling the truth. And it was agreed that he would be deported, and it worked out that way. But we now are in the terrorist business. When I went to law school and I became a judge, never in a million years did I think that we would be in the business of terrorism.
What did you think of the idea of trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any other 9/11 suspects in civilian court in New York?
Well, I'm a big fan of that. I mean, we have a rich history now, and the statistics are compelling that the federal judiciary can handle these cases, has handled major cases. We do it all the time. The Guantanamo case is pretty much the exception. We can handle it just fine in the federal courts, and that's where it belongs. There's no question about it.
Judge Frederick Block, he's written a book about the life and times of a federal judge called Disrobed. And Ed in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Judge Block. Judge, I'd like to press a little bit further, if I could, for your opinion regarding how our justice system treats the wealthy versus the rest of our citizens, following up on Brian's point before about whether or not there are enough Wall Street bankers facing prosecution. I'm not sure if you've read Glenn Greenwald's latest book, With Liberty and Justice for Some, or are familiar with his work, but Brian, you had him on a short while ago, during which he made a quite compelling indictment of a system that sanctions immunity at the top and mercilessness for everyone else. So I'd like to get your opinion, Judge, on the general inequality of justice and even the existence of a two-tiered system of justice, which ensures that the country's political and financial class is virtually immune from prosecution.
Well, obviously, I agree with your sentiments. You know, as a judge, we're on the receiving end. We don't make those decisions who to prosecute. That's the responsibility of the U.S. Attorney's Office. So we can't impact that world in a significant way. We just deal with what is presented to us. But I share your thoughts. I mean, there's no question that that is the fair thing to do, and we should be more, you know, attuned to it. But there's nothing I can do specifically about it except chat with you about it and agree with you 100%.
Well, what about when you have a high-profile defendant, famous for whatever reason, is there a bias that you have to work against in order to not sentence that person, if they're found guilty of something, to more than the average person? Maybe you want to make an example. The bias could run in either direction. Let the person off because they're a bigwig, or that is, go easy on the person because they're a bigwig, not let them off if they're convicted, or go tougher on them to make a point.
It's a difficult cup of tea. I have to sentence a spotter, and I can't talk about how I'm going to sentence him. But there's enormous public pressure on that case, you know, to
the former New York State Senate leader?
Yeah, he was the one that was sort of in charge of the Senate for a while.
Pedro Spot.
He's been convicted. I'll be sentencing him in some months. And I've got to put that out of my mind. I have to just look at the law, look at him as a human being, consider everything I ought to under the sentencing guidelines. And I always ask myself before I sentence somebody who's been in the press, am I really juicing this up because of the press that follows? And it's one of the things which I try to discipline myself not to do.
We're almost out of time. You were appointed by President Clinton. We see today how many of President Obama's judicial nominees get held up because Republicans in Congress see them as too liberal, or they're playing games and, you know, holding these appointments hostage for other kinds of deal making. Is the whole thing too politicized or more politicized than it used to be?
I think it's been pretty much the same type of thing. The last year of a presidential term, whether it's been Republican or Democrats, there's a tendency to hold up all judicial appointments. The politics about that is abhorrent, but that's the way the game plays. The best time to become a judge is the first year of a new president's term. They get stacked up. I came in that way. I'm not so sure that, you know, it's more anti-Obama than it was anti-Bush. I think pretty much it's been the same type of thing.
Is there any good way to select a judge? Elections aren't great because judges aren't supposed to make rulings based on what's popular or who they can get as campaign donors. Appointments aren't great because they tend to be political, which a judge isn't supposed to be either.
Well, I take the reader through the nomination process. You learn all about that when you read the book, but hopefully. We had the federal system, I think, is about the best because it's a system of embarrassments. You have to have something next to your name. No, you just can't apply for the job, and you have to be, you know, evaluated by all sorts of committees in the Justice Department and the FBI. And I think that's pretty good, and I think it works pretty good. And I think, you know, most of the judges would feel that the founding fathers got it about right. It's a controversial thing whether there should be lifetime appointments. We're living longer. Some of us are not doing so well in our old age. The founding fathers really put that aside and didn't really deal with that. There's legitimate issues back and forth. But by and large, I think the federal system and the founding fathers got it about right, and we have a terrific federal system. And I hope that when people read my book, they'll have a greater love and feeling for the system of justice. There are problems with it. And I like the fact that Jeff Toobin pointed out on the back that I write about what works and what doesn't work in America. And, of course, guns and drugs and the death penalty is a big part of those problems.
Cameras in the courtroom? Yes or no?
Look, certainly I see no reason why the proceedings of the Supreme Court should not be televised. I think that if there are certain cases where you're dealing with oral argument with lawyers, I think that there's nothing wrong with that. You have to be sensitive when you have a case like the Gotti case. When you're dealing with the jurors, they're scared to death, you know, to begin with. And if you put cameras in the courtroom, I'm afraid it could have an adverse effect. So you have to, I think, be reasonable and intelligent about it and know where to draw the line. We're not allowed to have it in the federal courts right now. I think we could be a little bit more open in that respect.
Judge Frederick Block, he sits in the Eastern District courtroom in Brooklyn of the U.S. federal court system, and has now let us all look behind the curtain a little bit with his new book, Disrobed, an inside look at the life and work of a federal trial judge. I appreciate your openness and your time. It's really been very educational, I think, for a lot of people.
Thank you for having me. I hope it's been helpful.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, a call-in for people who work in noisy workplaces and what to do about those dangerous decibel levels. Stay with us.